Thea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're digging into Portland's Leech Botanical Gardens and the community's effort to save it.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
At the corner of 122nd and Foster in southeast Portland, there's a 16-acre forest sanctuary that almost didn't come to exist. Today it's known as a hidden jewel of the city, the result of a nearly 100-year community intention. Some people don't even know it's here, while others rely on it for peace in the city. But after recovering from its time as a sawmill and a pig farm in the early 1900s, being spared from decades of urban development, and surviving a brush with abandonment in the 80s, this land is at a crossroads again. To understand what's at stake, we need to look back at the two people who rescued the land nearly a century ago and the world they built here, a private refuge that is now a cornerstone of the community. And although the plan to keep this place wild has been upheld by a 95-year streak of land stewardship, that future is uncertain today. We know it as Leech Botanical Garden. And if you live in an old Southeast Portland home, there's a chance your walls are made of timber grown and processed on the very same soil. But in 1931, when Lilla and John Leech looked at a plot depleted by its industrial and agricultural past, they saw the quiet potential they'd spent years dreaming of. For just $10, they bought the chance to restore a barren ravine into a lush botanical sanctuary. To find the garden today, you have to head to the edge of the Lentz neighborhood, where the deep green of the forest meets the gray of the urban corridor. If you step off the asphalt of 122nd Avenue and move into the trails of the garden, the first thing you notice is the sound. The hum of Southeast Portland doesn't disappear, but it gets pushed into the background by something much older. Luca is an intern at the garden. Katie and Eileen are volunteers.
The trickling of the water, the Pacific wrens in the trees. There's always a lot of birds in the morning here.
It's very peaceful. There's just a light rain and it feels like everything's waking up from the winter.
We hear lots of different bird calls. And then we hear the wind in the trees a lot, which is always enjoyable.
Beneath the 80-foot canopy of western red cedars and a massive giant sequoia, the ravine feels insulated from the city. Here, the sound of Johnson Creek sits under the calls of thrushes and wrens. On the forest floor, the first trilliums are emerging, with delicate carpets of oxalis and bleeding heart soon to follow. What is now a 16-acre sanctuary began as a 4.5-acre plot. The deep hollow provided a quiet escape that felt physically removed from the growing expansion of Portland. Named Sleepy Hollow because the secluded, misty atmosphere reminded Lilla and John of the classic short story, The name signaled their mission, to transform a degraded industrial site into a fairy tale sanctuary for their stone cabin and botanical work. Lilla's interest in plants started at a young age, as John Leach described in a 1968 recording.
Well, Lilla was raised on a farm out at Aurora, Oregon, and she loved flowers. She loved nature, everything in nature. And she used to go with her dog into the meadows and gather flowers when she was a very, very small child. When she got into college, she specialized in botany, and she went for it in a great way.
Lilla was described as a dreamer and a daring and courageous adventurer. She became one of Oregon's few pioneer women plant scientists, earning a degree in botany from the University of Oregon in 1908, allowing her to pursue the fieldwork she'd always dreamed of. Lilla's ambitions were backed by John's business sense. When they married in 1913, John vowed to take Lilla to rugged places where no cake-eating botanist would ever dare go. To fund that promise, he built a career in pharmacy, purchasing a struggling drugstore at 76th and Foster.
The only drugstore I could buy for $250 was a bootlegger's place where he called it the Phoenix Pharmacy because he had so many fires. I presume it was every time he got hard up, he had a fire. And the insurance company canceled his policies, and he couldn't make any money without fires and insurance, so he sold his drugstore very cheaply, and I bought it.
The Phoenix Pharmacy provided the financial power to fund months-long backcountry expeditions. While Lilla was a scientific lead, these journeys were a symbiotic partnership. She provided the botanical knowledge while John served as the planner. He managed the supplies and navigation of unmapped terrain so that Lilla could focus on hunting for specimens. Fundamental to these expeditions were two donkeys, Violet and Pansy, who carried their gear deep into the wilderness, allowing Lilla and John to document the peaks of the Wallowas, the dense forests of the Olympic Peninsula, and the botanical diversity of the Siskiyou Mountains. But the donkeys were more than equipment. John compared them to family dogs and liked to spoil them at the breakfast table.
They would come in the morning and nuzzle us to wake us up, and then they'd come back when we'd go to breakfast. We always had pancakes for breakfast, and they loved pancakes with syrup.
Decades of backcountry trips amounted to hundreds of plants, cuttings, and seeds that were carefully moved to Sleepy Hollow. Outside their botanical work, John became a civic leader in the Lentz neighborhood. He spent decades advocating for public parks and youth outdoorsmanship, believing kids needed the same grit and fresh air he and Lilla found in the mountains. For John, serving the Lentz District was a repayment for the life the neighborhood had given them, a personal philosophy he shared in his later years.
I have a philosophy that if a person comes into a district and works and makes a living in that district, he owes that district something, and he should pay it in leadership or money or some way.
Over three decades and thousands of miles, Lilla and John worked together to co-create hand-drawn plant maps that eventually became powerful tools for conservation advocacy. Their records of ancient plants found nowhere else on Earth ensured the prehistoric time capsule of the Chelmeopsis Wilderness was granted federal protection. In 1964, the sanctuary in Southwest Oregon became one of the first areas in the nation to be protected under the Wilderness Act. This established a permanent ban on roads, motors, and industry, a protection that remains in effect today across the entire 180,000-acre wilderness. But while they secured a sanctuary in the mountains, the post-war housing boom of the 1950s brought a new threat as Portland's forests were cleared for development. The couple spent the next 20 years watching the city sprawl close in. To protect their life's work from being developed, they made a calculated decision. They gave the city of Portland 10 years to commit to maintaining the botanical garden, or the land would go to the YMCA, an ultimatum designed to ensure the sanctuary never fell to developers. John died in 1972 at the age of 90, and Lilla lived on for 8 more years, passing away at the age of 94. By then, she'd been living nearly 2 decades with the physical toll of her life in the field. John spoke about the cost of those miles in a 1968 interview.
She was unfortunate in that she walked so many thousand miles through the woods and over the ridges in the mountains. And the x-rays show that her hips have the cartilages worn out.
Lilla's death in 1980 triggered the beginning of the 10-year clause. But for a time, the garden's future was uncertain. Sleepy Hollow sat in a state of dormancy as the once cared for grounds and buildings fell into disrepair. Facing a tight budget, the city was prepared to let the 10-year window expire, leaving the land to the YMCA. Then came a community-led turning point. In 1981, a group of dedicated neighbors formed Leech Garden Friends to restore the grounds and lobby for the site's botanical future. The momentum increased in 1982 when Charles Jordan, Portland's first Black Parks Commissioner, visited the property. He famously called it a hidden jewel and championed the partnership between the city and the neighbors. By 1983, the city voted to assume responsibility for the site, committing the funds and resources necessary to maintain it as a public park. The 10-year window was officially closed, and the garden opened to the public the same year, fulfilling the Leech's vision just 2 years before the deadline. Today, the mission of Lilla and John Leech is carried out by a convergence of local community groups. This includes environmental nonprofits, indigenous-led collectives, and students from nearby David Douglas High School. Because of this chain of stewardship, the sanctuary remains a rare corridor for the city's more timid residents. Along the creek, you might catch the flash of a coastal cutthroat trout or a kingfisher diving for a meal. Deeper in the shadows of the ravine, coastal giant salamanders hide under damp stones, while spring brings the first bunnies back to the undergrowth. The garden differs from a typical park. It's home to over 2,000 plant varieties, including a pollinator garden and a wide variety of native plants. There's also a habitat restoration area where invasive species have been removed to make room for more native plants, a commitment to the same restoration work the Leeches began a century ago. Today, on a 5-acre plot known as the Back Five, volunteers are working to reclaim a wetland that was once the Prohibition-era pig farm. Sometimes that work looks like a slow, grueling removal of invasive species that have taken hold over decades. One volunteer told me about the dedication it takes to make that happen.
The non-native strawberry is very tenacious. It doesn't want to come out, but it can with time and patience.
This massive restoration is currently managed by Flores, the Back Five Education and Ecology Manager. They rely on manual labor and a partnership with a local organization where indigenous elders share traditional ecological knowledge to guide the recovery of the land.
Yeah, the Back Five is filled with lots of love. The community is the one who tends to this land, and we have this very unique zone where we don't have harsh deadlines on this space. We don't use herbicides or pesticides. It's all people coming in with their hands and tending to the land in a way that feels sustainable. And that's how we go from brambles of blackberry that are 6 feet tall down to what we now see is just natives thriving. We have many partners that come into this space. Our volunteers are a force to be reckoned with. We also have wisdom of the elders teaching us how we can involve ourselves in this space that shows a lot of reciprocity. We all come together in this space that really, really is special. Hello. Thank you so much. I hope I see you next week. Yeah.
The garden recently saw its most significant investment so far, a $12.6 million expansion completed in 2021. The project transformed the 7-acre upper garden, adding a pollinator meadow planted with over 30,000 bulbs and a new network of accessible pathways. But the centerpiece is the aerial tree walk, a 400-foot-long elevated boardwalk that allows visitors to rise 36 feet into the forest canopy, making the tops of the towering cedars accessible to everyone, regardless of mobility. To ensure this new investment remains accessible to the surrounding neighborhood, Leech offers a Garden for All program. Anyone who finds the admission fee a barrier can request free entry. It's a no-questions-asked policy designed to ensure that financial barriers don't keep neighbors out of the forest in a neighborhood otherwise defined by concrete expanses. Development Director Jen Woodward tracks the success of these initiatives.
About 10% of our visitation is free entry. So having that accessible option really makes a difference in terms of the space being here for the folks that need it. Our primary visitation from zip code data is our immediate neighbors. So they're folks that live in Southeast Portland in the Lentz community. We know that they're coming here on a regular basis. That to us translates to we are a vital community space, a green space, where there's a lack of green space. And being able to provide respite and education opportunities in this neighborhood is really essential to us.
But providing that essential green space means operating against a decades-old legal framework that never prioritized this neighborhood for residential living. In 1981, Portland established the Industrial Sanctuary, a zoning fortress where industry is the legal priority. This policy created a permanent corridor where noise and loading docks are protected by law, effectively freezing neighborhood development and treating parks or public spaces as a conflict of interest. Residents here are caught in a legal loophole. Under City Code 33.258, they are classified as non-conforming. Because their homes are viewed as a mismatch for the land, these residents become invisible to planning, resulting in more than just a lack of parks. These areas lack the basic infrastructure other neighborhoods take for granted, from physical safeties like sidewalks, curbs, and street lighting, to essential health protections like air quality monitoring and legal quiet hours. This gap extends to libraries and community centers, as well as the tree canopies that serve as life-saving infrastructure in a warming climate. In 2024, City Council Resolution 394-2024 finally acknowledged that 68 miles of these industrial borders, including the Lentz neighborhood and wider Southeast Portland, sit directly against homes and schools. The resolution noted a stark disparity. Households in poverty are nearly 25% more likely to live on these edges. In response, the city directed planners to develop new zoning rules to protect residents from the noise, glare, and diesel exhaust of 24-hour warehouse operations. The tension today lies in the city's dual mission, preserving industry while drafting rules to buffer neighbors from that same development. As of March 2026, the Portland Planning Commission is actively debating these trade-offs through the Columbia Corridor and Industrial Lands Project. While new maps aim to protect human health, these industrial edges remain a threshold where economic growth and community survival are in direct competition. But while the city drafts new protections for these industrial edges, it is simultaneously withdrawing financial support for Leech Botanical Garden, a rare piece of green space and community infrastructure that already exists there. Mark Ross, Public Information Officer for Portland Parks and Recreation, describes the withdrawal of the garden's $350,000 annual subsidy as a necessary step toward the site's financial independence. The city states that the funding was always intended to be time limited, and that moving the nonprofit toward a self-sustaining model is a move toward autonomy rather than abandonment. Leech Garden actually had a roadmap to reach that goal, banking on a strategy of increased memberships and event rentals to fill the gap. But that plan was derailed by revenue that never materialized as a result of the COVID pandemic, and by the time restrictions lifted and large gatherings could return, the cost of labor and materials had increased. These economic impacts absorbed the garden's internal gains, shifting a planned transition into a $450,000 shortfall. Even with a one-time $100,000 bridge grant from the city, the math doesn't work. The shortfall has forced Leech to lay off 11 employees, half its staff, while those who remain have seen their working hours cut by 50%. The garden has also canceled 90% of its scheduled events. This means the end of historic tours, guided lichen walks, and community music programs that once brought Lent's families into the forest. On March 9, 2026, Leech announced a breakthrough in its emergency campaign, sharing that donors had contributed more than $274,000. This influx of community support has secured enough funding to keep the gates open through June 30th. But this is only a temporary lifeline. The garden is urging the mayor and city council to restore $450,000 in the upcoming budget to ensure the garden's survival. In the meantime, Development Director Jen Woodward suggests several ways the community can get involved.
I think that the community role really is one where you decide what level of engagement makes sense to you. That's visiting. Fantastic. If you don't have time to visit, but you do have dollars that you can contribute, donations make a big difference. If you love the garden so much you want to be here all the time, memberships are a wonderful way to support. We just need also cheerleaders and advocates that can be out there telling other people, please support this space in the way that makes sense to you. We always need garden volunteers and folks that are passionate about the mission to reach out and to become part of the story here. It's funny that we hear so often that people haven't been here. Some people have grown up here and either haven't heard of us or just haven't been here.
Across the river, Forest Park offers thousands of acres of wilderness to the communities of the West Side. But for Portlanders living in a neighborhood with very little green, this is their forest. The budget crisis at Leech Botanical Garden is a metaphor for how human worth is valued in a landscape designed for utility. While Woodward notes the many people who remain unaware of the garden's existence, an even larger question remains. How many are unaware of the disparity by design that shapes their environment? The impact of a map drawn to prioritize the economic engine over the fundamental equity of peace. Leech Botanical Garden is open Thursday through Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 6704 Southeast 122nd Avenue in Portland. Thank you to the Oregon Historical Society Research Library for sharing the oral history interview with John R. Leech by Jean S. Whitford, SR 758. More information about Wisdom of the Elders is online at wisdomoftheelders.org. For KBOO Community Radio, I'm Nina Mayfair.
Water as a weapon of war. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The U.S. and Israeli war against Iran is creating deep concern over drinking water supplies in the Middle East.
Major urban areas in the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea rely on desalination plants that remove salt from seawater to produce fresh water, and almost all of those facilities run on energy generated from fossil fuels.
A few of these desal plants have become targets of bombs, drones, and missile strikes by the combatants. About 10 days ago, Iran accused the U.S. of damaging a desalination facility that supplies 30 villages. A spokesperson for the U.S. denied that allegation.
Then Iran allegedly damaged a desalination plant in Bahrain. Analysts worry that it's the culmination of a long-feared scenario in the Middle East in which water becomes a weapon of war.
Michael Christopher Lowe, director of Utah University's Middle East Center, wrote in The Conversation that while the Gulf's monarchies are often described as petrostates, he calls them saltwater kingdoms, superpowers in the production of fresh water from the sea.
Facilities that supply drinking water are theoretically protected under international law, but U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth said that the American forces will not follow any, quote, stupid rules of engagement.
Mohammed Mahmoud of the UN told the New York Times that it's absolutely a war crime to attack infrastructure that civilians depend on by either side.
Before the war started, Iran had already been suffering from water shortages caused by drought, climate change, mismanagement of infrastructure, and overuse by agriculture.
Last year, the capital city of Tehran, with its 10 million inhabitants, had little rain and its reservoirs were stressed.
But last weekend, what has been described as black rain fell on the city. It was oil-soaked rain caused by fires producing smoke clouds following airstrikes by the U.S. and Israel on oil depots, according to CNN.
Euronews reports that the plumes of toxic contamination likely contained precursors to acid rain and carcinogenic compounds from the burning hydrocarbons. Residents were urged to stay indoors.
Long-term health risks from the smoke include neurological and heart conditions, birth complications, and cancer.
The pollutants can stay on buildings and get into waterways, affecting ecosystems for a long time.
Iran has attempted to close the Strait of Hormuz to prevent oil tankers from moving through the region, which has sent gas prices soaring. That's making people look to buy electric vehicles and install solar panels.
If demand grows, despite the Trump administration killing the rebates and incentives put in place under Biden, it will require more lithium for car batteries and energy storage.
Although EVs and renewables have lower environmental impacts, harvesting lithium, whether through open pit mines or brine ponds, can deplete fresh water, pollute ecosystems with toxic chemicals, and release greenhouse gases.
A team of researchers at Rice University might have found a win-win solution. They are using toxic PFAS compounds, also known as forever chemicals, to extract lithium from briny water. The compounds are destroyed in the process, solving two problems at once.
PFAS substances are everywhere, in our water, in our air, and us, because they're used in so many products, from cookware to waterproof clothing and food packaging. Studies have linked them to liver damage, reproductive disorders, immune system disruption, and certain cancers.
Activated carbon is used to remove PFAS from water, but as James Tour of Rice University told H2O Radio, the carbon is often thrown in the garbage, and the PFAS ends up in the environment again.
So Tour and his team decided to turn that trash into treasure. In their study, they took PFAS-saturated carbon and mixed it with brine. They then flash-heated the mixture, which produced lithium fluoride.
Tour and his team tested their lithium fluoride in batteries, and they showed increased stability and performance.
They say their approach uses less energy and water than the two most common methods to extract lithium from brine, and they say it will likely have lower operating costs and be faster, taking only a few minutes rather than months to complete. And finally, do you know your warblers from your sparrows, finches from flycatchers? If so, your brain is likely aging well.
That's the conclusion of a new Canadian study which looked at the brains of birdwatchers and found that expert birders had more structurally compact areas related to attention and perception than the rest of us who might only recognize a duck from a seagull.
Birding requires a keen eye and strong memory, but as we age, our brain structure becomes less complex. The team says that bird watching can build neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to change, reorganize, and grow neural networks.
The study used MRIs to track how water moved through brain tissue to determine its density. Denser areas are associated with working memory, spatial awareness, and object recognition.
They found that expert birders had denser tissue compared with novices, even though they were roughly the same age.
That doesn't mean birders will avoid cognitive decline, but it might happen more slowly, giving new meaning to the word bird brain.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
KBOO Portland.